So today we will continue to explore the notion of particle. Remember that we decomposed quantum fields into individual harmonic oscillators, and then we interpreted the excitation of these harmonic oscillators as the presence of particles. Now, these harmonic oscillators are associated to points in momentum space. That's where they are independent harmonic oscillators, right? In position space, we had harmonic oscillators, but they were coupled. In momentum space, they're uncoupled harmonic oscillators, and we can define the vacuum then as the joined ground state of all those harmonic oscillators for all the momenta. And then we said that if the harmonic oscillator associated to a particular momentum is, let's say, in its third excited state, it means three particles of that momentum are present. Now, that's some notion of particle here, but it's a limited notion because it tells us about the presence of particles of fixed momentum. What if we want to know whether there are particles here or there? It turns out that that's kind of possible in quantum field theory to extract local information through Fourier transform, but it's not straightforward and there are limitations to how well we can localize particles. A different concept, a different approach to the notion of particle, as we briefly mentioned before, is to say a particle is by definition what a particle detector detects. And a particle detector could be a huge machine like the machines they have at CERN. But a particle detector could be as small as an atom, for example, where the detection of a photon registers as the excitation of the atom from its ground state to its whatever excited state. This concept has proven very successful. We couple a first quantized system, such as a molecule or an atom or maybe an ion, to a quantum field. And in this way, the atom, ion, molecule can probe properties of the quantum field. The huge advantage of using this first quantized atom or ion or molecule is that since it is first quantized, we still have position operators for it, momentum operators for it. We still have the interpretation of its wave functions as describing probability amplitudes for finding the particle here or there. First quantization is interpretationally much easier. So that's quite successful in order to extract local information from a quantum field. So let's adopt that notion of particle for now. We will come back to the other notion of excitation of field oscillators in momentum space. But for now, let's adopt that notion. So what we will study, therefore, is the interaction between matter in the form of, let's say, atoms and quantum fields. Therefore, what we do in this lecture today is the framework that will allow you to calculate, for example, decay rates of excited atoms. At what rate does an excited atom decay into its ground state while emitting a photon? And you can also use these methods to calculate the absorption cross-section of an atom or molecule when a photon comes along. But that will not be our focus today. Instead, we will first introduce the machinery that's needed to describe the interaction between a piece of matter, such as an atom, and the quantum field. And then we will apply it to test the notion of particle that comes with it. The notion that a particle is what a particle detector detects. And you will see that it's highly non-trivial. Namely, that the particle detector can click in situations where we would not normally think that there is a particle. For one, a particle detector might click, that is to say, an atom might get excited from its ground state, simply by coupling it to a quantum field. And this will be relevant for gravity then, also acceleration can lead to the excitation of particle detectors. Even if in the lab frame there are no particles around, the particle detector might respond, might click, if you accelerate the particle detector. And what this means is that according to the definition, the particle is what a particle detector detects. According to that definition, an accelerated observer will see particles, even when a non-accelerated observer doesn't see any. Now you might think, okay, that's just because we use this concept that the particle is what a particle detector detects. But no, as we will see later on in this course, when we will study again what an accelerated observer sees, we will see that even when we use the other notion of particle, namely the excitation of field oscillators in momentum space, we will find the same phenomenon, namely that accelerated observers see particles where non-accelerated observers don't. It also works the other way around, by the way. In principle, you could have the field in a state in which an accelerated observer doesn't see any particles, but an inertial observer would. Okay, so today we do it, we calculate this phenomenon that acceleration can lead to particles using the framework of having a atom play the role of a detector in a quantum field. And then later in this course, we will recalculate that notion from the perspective of particles being defined as excitations of mode oscillators of quantum fields. The whole thing is a preparation for gravity, because through the equivalence principle, you know, you shouldn't be able to distinguish phenomena of acceleration from phenomena of gravity. But we will still do it in the safety of just a Minkowski space background, where we already know how everything works. Okay, so the phenomenon that an accelerated observer will see particles where in the lab frame there are no particles, that phenomenon is called the Unruh effect, named after Bill Unruh, who is a prof at UBC, and his work is from 1976, so it's like ages ago. Still not measured, though. Still not measured because it takes an enormous acceleration to get a measurable excitation rate. And yet, nobody doubts that the effect is there. All right, so in principle, what's predicted here is that if you take an ice cube and you attach some sort of cable to it, and then pull really hard so that it accelerates like crazy, this ice cube should start melting. So even if you do that in outer space, it's in the vacuum, just accelerate it very, very strongly and this thing should start melting. Now here's the intuition for why that is so. Consider again waves in a pond. And we put a cork in there again, but we rigged this cork. Remember what we did to it? We cut it into two pieces, and then we put a little metal spring in between the two pieces so that the cork can oscillate. It has an internal degree of freedom. So the cork as a whole can move up and down, for example, but it also has an internal degree of freedom, just like an atom. It has an internal excitation degree of freedom. So, for example, you could squeeze the cork and then let go, and then it will vibrate for a little bit, and those vibrations will create waves. And vice versa, if this thing is at rest in here, and then a wave comes along, it might excite this. So that's just a mechanical analog of the atom in a field. Now imagine you take this cork, you attach some sort of string to it, and then you pull it through the water. In an accelerated way, you can imagine how this is exciting both. The cork is exciting waves, but the waves will also back react onto the cork. Just generally, if you have one system interact strongly with the other will react back on the original system, right? It's just action and reaction. Similarly, when we take a charge, or you take a neutral atom or something with a dipole moment, something that interacts with the field, and you pull it through a quantum field in an accelerated way. And it's got to be accelerated, because if you pull it in an inertial way, then you're really not doing anything, because you can go into the rest frame of that particle, where you're not doing anything, right? Only when you accelerate it can you not go to the rest frame. Then something else might happen. So as you accelerate it, as you accelerate, say, some ion through an electromagnetic field, you're generally creating a disturbance in the electromagnetic field. You're creating radiation. But our ion is interacting with the field in a two-way fashion. The interaction Hamiltonian is not a one-way street. So if the interaction Hamiltonian allows interaction between the atom and the field, it also allows an interaction of the field and the atom. Therefore, we should not be surprised that if the ion is able to create electromagnetic waves, in the same process, the electromagnetic field might excite the ion. And that is what's happening, and that's the Andrew effect. It's usually presented in more mysterious terms, and we will later see in this course how you can also derive it. You can talk about a horizon that arises when your ion is uniformly accelerated, then it sees a horizon, you can trace over what's beyond that horizon, and you find a mixed state and excitations and so on. So it all looks a little bit more mysterious in this way. And it's also closer in spirit than to Hawking radiation of a black hole, because it has a horizon too. But I'm introducing it in this way to demystify it, because this is just about action and reaction, really. If the ion can create waves in the electromagnetic field, then the electromagnetic field can excite the ion, just because it's the same interaction Hamiltonian, action and reaction. And the acceleration doesn't have to be uniform. The acceleration doesn't even have to take forever. You could have a temporary acceleration, and you would still get excitation. But in a temporary acceleration, you do not have a horizon. What this means is that the Andrew effect, the phenomenon that an ion will get excited when accelerated, that phenomenon does not depend on there being an horizon. That's important, because ultimately this also opens up the question, do we really need to have a horizon for a black hole in order to have Hawking radiation to emanate from it? But we're not there yet. Okay, so the phenomenon that an ion gets excited while accelerated through a quantum field is the Andrew effect. And we interpret this as the ion detecting photons. So the ion sees particles where in the lab frame there are no particles. So how do we describe such ions? First of all, in the literature, the terminology is that we call an atom whose role it is to probe the field, the quantum field, we call such an atom a detector. More precisely, they're usually called Andrew de Witt detectors, because Andrew and de Witt were the first people to suggest to use atoms, molecules, or ions as probes, as localized probes of properties of the quantum field, as detectors of photons. Actually, these Andrew de Witt detectors, or just detectors for short, not only detect, you can also use them to put information into a field, right? You could prepare an atom in an excited state, and then it will emit a photon. It doesn't have to be prepared in a ground state to absorb a photon. So detector is not really a very good word for that, because you can use such atoms both as senders of information and as receivers of information. And there's a whole field of research that just studies the impact of quantum mechanics or quantum theory on the ability to transmit information between senders and emitters. And the simplest model is to have an atom as a sender, then a quantum field, and then an atom as a receiver. For example, one of the results of these studies was obtained by one of my PhD students, and it is that in quantum fields, it's actually possible to send information from one atom to another atom through a quantum field. In special circumstances, it's possible to send that information without sending energy. The receiver has to spend energy, the sender has to spend energy, but no energy is actually traveling from the sender to the receiver. All right, so how do we describe now those detectors? A detector at rest would have this world line here. X mu of tau is tau, 0, 0, 0. Why? Well, if something is at rest, it still moves through space-time, but only in the time direction, right? So in the time direction, its coordinate is increasing, but of course in the space direction, if it sits at the origin of the coordinate system, it just sits there at 0, 0, 0. Also, let's assume, it's usually assumed in the literature too, that these detectors have infinite mass. Now, if you assume that they have infinite mass, it makes things much easier because it means you can treat their location as a classical location. You see, if a physical object has a small mass, then its wave function spreads relatively fast. If it has a large mass, then its wave function spreads very, very little. If it has infinite mass, its wave function doesn't spread at all. So, for convenience, we could say, well, let's assume we know where our detector is and where it will be. So we do not take into account that its center of mass is actually described by a wave function that flows apart. We recently published a paper on, you know, the phenomena that arise when you take that into account. But in most studies, the center of mass of our atom is assumed known, classical, and following some trajectory. So for today's lecture, let's stick to this paradigm. So we have a trajectory, which in the simplest case would be just the particle, that the atom sitting at the origin. The case of constant velocity would be this one. So our x mu of tau is a tau times b vector tau. Remember, that's the time component here, and that is the space component. Tau is the proper time of our detector. Then we need that this is holding in order that a squared minus b vector squared is 1. If we choose this, and I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that, then we have a trajectory of constant acceleration. If you dig further down the lecture notes, you will find the proof somewhere. But it's not earlier. Somewhere it is there. Okay. So, for example, the case of constant acceleration in the x direction would be this one. We have that x naught of tau, so the lab time x naught, as a function of the proper time of the detector. Detector is the atom, is alpha hyperbolic sine tau divided by alpha. And then the x1 and x2 coordinates and x3 coordinates are these. The x2 and x3 coordinates are 0, but in the x1 direction we are moving, and this is the behavior. You can easily check that this trajectory is a trajectory of uniform acceleration. It's just easiest to work with uniform acceleration rather than some more complicated accelerations. It just turns out that you can carry out the calculations to the very end if you do uniform acceleration. There are few trajectories where you can do it. Now the case of constant acceleration in the x3 direction, as I said, is given by this trajectory, and constant acceleration means literally that x double dot mu contracted is constant, where the x double dot mu vector is the acceleration vector, right? So the x dot vector is the velocity, and then in four-dimensional space, and then x double dot is the acceleration. So this is a covariant way of saying that the acceleration is constant. And then for low velocities at very early times, time close to zero, it's a very small velocity. You see, this is describing a trajectory where a particle comes in with very high velocity, then decelerates to zero velocity at time zero, and then accelerates. And for small times, we have a non-relativistic approximation of the trajectory. And the non-relativistic approximation, if you plug it in here, is that the trajectory is tau a plus b tau squared. But in non-relativistic mechanics, you see that this is constant acceleration. Now, of course, you can do this argument not only for small times. You can also do it 5 minutes later when the particle is already very fast. You just have to go into the rest frame 5 minutes later and then expand around that. This is how you see that that condition, x double dot, the length of the x double dot vector is constant, is in every local inertial frame, at any time, it is the condition of local acceleration being constant. And always the same value. Okay, so we have two trajectories here. We have the inertial trajectory and the uniformly accelerated trajectory to compare. Now, what about the quantum field? Let's assume that for an initial inertial observer, that is to say, in the Minkowski coordinate system, in the lab frame, our field phi hat, which will stand in for the electromagnetic field. We are just dropping some issues with the vector valuedness of the electromagnetic field here by describing it as a scalar field. But in principle, the whole thing works through, even if you do it with electromagnetism. So we assume that for an inertial observer, the field phi hat is in the Minkowski space vacuum, which means if you decompose it by Fourier transform into its modes, then you get these independent mode oscillators, and we assume that the field starts out in the joint ground state of all of these harmonic oscillators. And remember that we solved the problem of quantum field theory for that case. The problem of quantum field theory consisting of fulfilling the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, fulfilling the canonical commutation relations, and the hermeticity conditions. All of that was fulfilled with this solution here. Namely, phi hat of x is the Fourier transform of the phi hat of k. Right? We just did the Fourier transform. And then the phi hat of k, that was for an independent harmonic oscillator. And the solution we found was that the phi hat of k as a function of time, time is now called x naught. It's the lab time, because the whole thing is written down in the lab frame. Phi hat of k of tau is given by some function times a plus some function times a dagger minus k. And this function, if you remember, we found to be this one. It arose from, remember when we did the individual harmonic oscillator? And in the in region or in the out region for the free harmonic oscillator, that is to say, we found that the a operator is simply some a naught operator multiplied with a phase that depends on time. That was this. And we're dealing here with a free field so far. We haven't coupled it to our unruh de Witt detector yet. We haven't coupled it to an atom yet. Just describing the free field. So our solution was that phi hat of k is some function times a plus complex conjugate of that function times a dagger of minus k, where these functions in front of the a and a dagger operators are these phases. These functions we will see come up very often, and they are going to be super important in the rest of this course. They are called the mode functions. So these are scalar functions multiplying these a and a dagger operators in our solution. When later we will study quantum field theory in expanding space-times or generally curved space-times, these mode functions are going to be much more complicated than just an exponential. And the frequency of the mode oscillator k is of course omega k, with omega k being square root of k vector squared plus m squared. Again, that will change in an expanding space-time, or just generally when there is curvature. So if you now put the two things together, This was the solution of the individual mode harmonic oscillators. If we plug that back into the Fourier transform, so we plug that into here, and then we obtain the phi hat of x. And you remember, we had this on the board last time, at the end of last lecture. Phi hat of x is this. This is a complete solution now of the free quantum field theory in Minkowski space. And you see that there are these phase factors. They have different origin. There is the phase factor that comes from the time evolution of the harmonic oscillator. And then there's the phase factor that comes from the Fourier transform from position to time. They look very similar in this case, because it's Minkowski space. But on an expanding space-time, we should expect that the Fourier transform, or something like the Fourier transform, very similar, should still be possible, because we have translation invariance in an FRW space-time. But if the time evolution is non-trivial, we would expect that this part, the mode function, will be non-trivial. And that's what we will see. Non-trivial mode functions, but still relatively trivial spatial Fourier factors. In Minkowski space, that's all we have. Very simple. OK, so this phi hat of x acts then on the Hilbert space, which consists of the tensor product of all those Hilbert spaces of the individual mode oscillators. How? Well, you see, the phi hat is expressed in terms of the A and A dagger operators that act on these mode oscillators. And we integrate over all of them. That's why we have a D3K in here. So the phi hat of X operator is a rather complicated thing. It's a huge linear combination of the A and A dagger operators of these mode oscillators. But, and that's the main thing, we know how it acts. Whatever state we assume for the quantum field, whatever excitations of the quantum field we have, we know how phi hat of x acts on that state. So now let's consider a particle that travels on the trajectory that we want to consider. So let's consider the detector system more closely. Something like an ion. So what's that supposed to be? Well, we want this to be a small, localized system. Something like an atom. Something like helium once ionized, or something like that. You see, if we ionize it, then it has a monopole moment. It has a charge, interacts with the field very strongly. If instead we have something like, I don't know, water molecule, that thing is neutral. It doesn't interact with the electromagnetic field as strongly. It only interacts through its dipole. But in principle, it doesn't matter whether we have a monopole, dipole, quadrupole, or whatever interaction. We just have some interaction between a localized quantum system, such as an atom, a molecule, or an ion, and the quantum field. So let's assume we have one of these small localized systems, and it's traveling on some path x mu of tau that we can describe classically. So we assume that it's heavy enough so that its path can be described by some line that we can draw classically with sufficient accuracy. So this, and what could be the internal excitation degree of freedom of this thing? The internal degree of freedom that we use to absorb photons, or if you want to, emit photons. Well, it could be, if this is, let's say, helium plus, what could it be? It could be the energy levels of the electron. Right? So if our helium plus is absorbing a photon, it means its electron gets lifted up to a high energy level. But it could also be something very different. It could be, for example, that our first quantized system here is a molecule, something like H2 or some other molecule. But let's say it's simply a diatomic molecule, a molecule made out of two atoms. Then these two atoms will have a certain ideal distance between them. If you get them much closer, then the repulsion of the nuclei will keep them further apart. And if you go much further, then the overall electron clouds will bring them closer again. So typically, they have a harmonic oscillator potential between them. It's not harmonic all the way, because obviously, if you have sufficiently much energy, then you break the molecule. So the potential looks typically, for something like H2, the potential as a function of the distance between the nuclei looks typically like it starts out like a harmonic oscillator, but then it flattens. And if you supply any energy larger than the plateau, you ionize the thing. But with, for some diatomic molecules, you have at least a little bit of harmonic behavior. So the first few energy levels are actually equidistantly spaced. And then they become more and more tightly spaced, just like in the hydrogen atom. And then eventually you have the continuum above with the scattering states. So it could be anything here, our first quantized system. It could be some atom with its energy level spacing, and then it could also be some diatomic molecule where the energy spacing starts out harmonic, and then it becomes unharmonic, and then it flattens out, and you have a continuous spectrum above it for the scattering states. The point is, we want it to be first quantized. So it's just the usual description. We don't use quantum field theory for the description of that particle, even though, of course, fundamentally, there is a quantum field theoretical description of the hydrogen atom, H2, and everything else. Literally everything else. So first quantized. Now the Hamiltonian of our detector system acts on its own Hilbert space that we may call Curly H detector. So this would be the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom, for example, acting on the Hilbert space of the hydrogen atom. And we assume that the spectrum of this detector system is discrete. Of course, for very high excitations, you can rip this thing apart. So eventually, it becomes continuous. But we are not usually exploring that range where we would dissociate the system. So therefore, the total quantum system consists of two quantum systems. The first quantized quantum system of our atom, say, and the second quantized system of the field. So we have two Hilbert spaces. And we have a Hamiltonian, a total Hamiltonian, that has three contributions. The total Hamiltonian of this system will be the Hamiltonian of the detector, acting on the Hilbert space of the detector, tensor the identity. It acts as the identity operator on the Hilbert space of the field, because it really has nothing to say there. And then we have the Hamiltonian of the field acting on the Hilbert space of the field. That's the second tensor factor here by definition. It acts as the identity on the atom. And then there's an interaction Hamiltonian. And that interaction Hamiltonian contains contributions on both tensor factors that are operators. That's how the two quantum systems interact with each other. That's how one can excite the other and vice versa. That's how our atom or molecule, when dragged along, can excite the field, and how the field can also excite the atom or ion. So in the total Hilbert space that we can write as total Hilbert space is the tensor product of the Hilbert space of the detector and the Hilbert space of the field. So this is where all of this happens. Now, the interaction Hamiltonian consists, as we said, of operators of both subsystems. The interaction Hamiltonian may be time-dependent. So I put a tau in here. It may or may not be time-dependent. It depends on how we set things up. And typically, the model, the simplest model for the interaction between light and matter, has an interaction Hamiltonian of this form. Let's analyze that. So remember, the interaction Hamiltonian is the third term up there, right? So we have free Hamiltonian of the detector, free Hamiltonian of the field, and here's the interaction Hamiltonian. So the interaction Hamiltonian has typically this form. It has some prefactor epsilon of tau, which is a number-valued function of time that we get to choose. If the atom interacts with the field all the time, then that function is just a constant. But if we sort of switch on the interaction and switch off the interaction, for example, we could have an atom that we have in a kind of a Faraday cage, and then we open it and close it again. So if we control the interaction, then we model that simply by not explaining the entire Faraday cage, but simply by just writing down epsilon of tau. And in this way, we give ourselves the opportunity to mathematically describe the switching on and switching off of the interaction between our atom or ion and the field. Sometimes it's convenient we have this function, and sometimes we just leave it out if the thing is always interacting with the field. And then we have here an operator which acts on the Hilbert space of the detector. It acts on the Hilbert space of our atom. So it's some observable, because it's some Hermitian operator, and that could be something like a position operator, something like a momentum operator, or the Hamiltonian. Just generally, it could be some operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the atom. It's made out of the position and momentum operators in principle. It's made out of the position and momentum operators of our atom. Now here, we have an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the field. And one usually chooses the field itself. Obviously, it acts on the Hilbert space of the field. Now, we are not writing down here the phi hat everywhere. We are writing down the phi hat, the field degree of freedom, the field operator, at the location x naught of tau, x vector of tau, which you recognize is the position of our atom. That makes sense. The interaction takes place where the atom is. The field is everywhere, but it feels the atom only where the atom is. So we have here the interaction between the detector, the atom, and here we have the location of the atom, and the field is taken at that location. So that's the interaction Hamiltonian, and you notice that this is technically a tensor product here. It's this operator tensor that operator. In the literature, usually that tensor product symbol is omitted, but just keep in mind that in principle that's happening here. There is a tensor product, because this thing acts on a different Hilbert space than that is. That acts on the Hilbert space of the field, that acts on the Hilbert space of our atom. So it's a tensor product. One operator acting on the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces. So you have to also write down the tensor product of the operators. So for example, how could that look like in practice? This is the idealized version of it. In practice, it could be this. For example, we could have that in for our atom here, or ion, or molecule, whatever. This could be a spin. This could be a spin operator, S3, for example, of our atom or molecule, or maybe it's just an electron alone. And here, the field, that could be the electromagnetic field. And in particular, it could be, let's say, the third component of the magnetic field. So we could have here the spin magnetic field interaction between the two. Or in the electromagnetic interaction, you also get a coupling between the momentum operator of an electron that goes around a nucleus and the electromagnetic field three potential. That's also something that comes up naturally. Now, we will not specialize on either this interaction or that interaction. We will simply leave open what that operator is, whether this is a spin operator, momentum operator, position operator. There's also a dipole interaction where there's an electric field here, etc. We'll just leave it open what operator that is. It depends on how we couple to the field. Right? So, for example, if our Unruh de Vit detector is a hydrogen atom, then we might want to use this one. This would be the appropriate one for the electron's momentum, assuming that the nucleus is so heavy that we can assume it to be fixed in space. So it's only the electron that has this degree of freedom. But on the other hand, we could have an H2 molecule. And what we're interested in is the coupling between the electromagnetic field and the harmonic oscillation that the two nuclei have against each other. Then we would have to write down another interaction Hamiltonian. So the main thing is we write the field here and then some operator that belongs to the Unruh de Vit detector model, whatever that might be in practice. The details will depend on that. right? If there's a vector structure and so on, but the overall strategy for calculating the way in which an excited detector can decay and emit a photon into the field, or vice versa, that a photon from the field is detected by our detector by getting excited, the strategy for calculating that is all the same. And of course, our aim here is not primarily to find out how to calculate absorption and emission rates, even though that will be just popping out on the side. No, our aim is to see whether detectors can get excited just by acceleration, even in the vacuum. And we will find that this is the case. And that not only the detector gets excited, also the field gets excited. So we will find that if you accelerate a detector, an unruly DV detector, through space-time, then the unruly DV detector will radiate off photons in all directions, almost all directions, and it will also have a chance of getting excited. And then as a special case, you will be able to calculate for an inertial system easily what its decay and absorption and emission rates are. Both spontaneous emission and also induced emission, right? If you have an atom that's already in excited state, then you can hit it with a photon of the right frequency, and that will motivate the atom to decay faster. That's induced emission. You can calculate all of these things by the end of the lecture today. Okay, so the time evolution of our total system we need to calculate. How do we do this? Well, we have the Hamiltonian now for this total system. We just have to run the time evolution of this. But this can be complicated because we're dealing with a large Hilbert space for the field and potentially a very large Hilbert space also for our detector system. Now, it's quite realistic to assume that the detector efficiency is small, that this prefactor in front of the interaction Hamiltonian is a small number. For electromagnetism, the coupling constant, the prefactor in front of the interaction Hamiltonian, is the fine structure constant, which is less than 1%, right? It's 1 over 137, so it's a small number. So we can assume that this is small, and therefore we can use perturbation theory. The whole story is a bit more complicated than this. But in general, we can use perturbation theory for quantum electrodynamics quite straightforwardly. So we will do this here. Secondly, when we do perturbation theory, it's usually advisable to use the Dirac picture of time evolution. Again, if you're not familiar with the Dirac picture, or also called the interaction picture of time evolution, then let me know after class and I'll send you a link to my lecture notes for quantum mechanics, where I explain exactly how that's obtained. In the interaction picture, or Dirac picture, the time evolution is different from the Heisenberg picture and the Schrödinger picture. It takes a bit of each. In the Dirac picture, the operators evolve according to the free time evolution, and the states evolve according to the interaction Hamiltonian only, where the operators in the interaction Hamiltonian evolve according to the free time evolution, right? Because they're operators. So that's a subtle thing that's sometimes overlooked. So again, in the Dirac picture, the operators evolve freely according to the free Hamiltonians. Free Hamiltonian of the field, free Hamiltonian of the detector. So all operators' time evolution can be solved right away because we can solve the free theory. And then the states are evolving according to a Schrödinger equation, where the only Hamiltonian that occurs in the Schrödinger equation is the interaction Hamiltonian. Now, the interaction Hamiltonian contains operators. Those operators need also to be evolved as operators are in this picture, namely according to the free time evolution. Let's just keep that in mind. Okay, so the operators evolve according to the free time evolution. So the free Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian of the detector, tends to the identity, plus identity tends to the free Hamiltonian of the field. This governs the time evolution of the operators. So for example, this operator in the interaction Hamiltonian here, the Q hat, of tau is then evolving according to this. So we have this operator. It is really the operator tensor, the identity. You see this operator q hat naught is acting on the Hilbert space of our detector. Tensor, the identity, because it's acting trivially on the Hilbert space of the field. And then we put the time evolution operator that corresponds to the free time evolutions Hamiltonians to the left and to the right. That's the total time evolution. Now the field time evolution operator is only acting on this where we have the identity, so those unitaries just cancel each other out. Right? If you exponentiate this, it just evolves the identity. But the time evolution of the identity is the identity. Right? So we have to write this and that in here and in there. And because this commutes with that, we have that it's a unitary times a unitary here and a unitary times a unitary there. Unitary on the Hilbert space of the detector, tensor unitary on the Hilbert space of the field, and here the same thing. And for the field, it's just u, u dagger, and in the middle the identity. So that goes all the way. And so we just have the time evolution of the detector acting on here and the time evolution of the detector acting there. Tensor the identity. Now, the quantum states in the Dirac picture evolve according to the interaction Hamiltonian. And so the total time evolution operator for the states in the Dirac picture is given by the time-ordered exponential of the integrated interaction Hamiltonian. But keep in mind again, it's only the interaction Hamiltonian that occurs in here. Because it may be time-dependent, remember the epsilon of tau, because it may be time-dependent, we have to put the time ordering operator in here. Do you remember all why that is? It's because the Hamiltonian at one time may not even commute with the Hamiltonian at another time. So in order to make this a solution to the Schrödinger equation with this Hamiltonian, we have to use the time ordering operator here, which kicks in the expansion of this exponential from the second order onwards. Because in the first order, in the zeroth order, it's just one, the identity. The first order, it's just this integral once. And the second order of the perturbation theory, the second term in the Taylor expansion of the exponential, has the interaction Hamiltonian twice. And then we will start to order. But to very first order in the perturbation theory, we don't need the time ordering operator just yet, which will be very convenient, because we will just do it to first order. So for small detector efficiency, epsilon of tau, or for small coupling between the field and the detector, we can do an expansion. And we write this unitary time evolution of the states as 1 in the Taylor expansion, the leading term, plus I times this integral, where we can drop the time ordering because there is only one operator. There's no issue of commutativity coming up. So to first order in the interaction strength, that's the time evolution operator for our states, where the interaction Hamiltonian was spelled out. It is epsilon, tau, and then we have the q, and we have the phi, where the field is evaluated at the location of the detector. Now this integral runs from minus infinity to tau in principle. I mean, in principle, it runs from the initial time tau initial to the final time tau final, but we can choose the initial time to be minus infinity. Because if the interaction didn't start at minus infinity, we can take care of that by choosing our switching function such that it only switches on when the interaction really switched on. So we're not losing any generality if we make that integral run from minus infinity. All right, so far we have the setup. We know which equations we have to solve, but we also need to think now about the initial conditions. What state shall we prepare our detector in? And what state shall we prepare our field in? Now, you could do anything you want here. You could, for example, be interested in emission rates. How would you calculate an emission rate now? Well, you would choose as your initial state of the detector, let's say the first excited state of the hydrogen atom, and the initial state of the field to be the vacuum state. Then you run the time evolution to first order, as we do now, and then you would find a probability as a function of time of finding that the detector is in its ground state and the field is in its first excited state, that the photon has been created of some momentum. That's how you could calculate that. Or you could also calculate an absorption cross-section. How do you do that? Well, now the initial state would be that the field starts out in an excited state and the detector in a ground state, and then run the time evolution. And after you've run the time evolution for a while, you ask, what's the probability that I find the state where the detector is excited and the field is in the vacuum state? This way, you get the probability for absorption. But we're not going to be interested in either of these, right? Instead, we say, wait a moment, what if the field starts out in the vacuum and the detector starts in the ground state? Right? In this case, what happens? Could it be that if the trajectory is accelerated, we end up with the detector excited and the field excited? And that's what we will find. But just keep in mind that you might as well just work in Minkowski space where the detector is sitting somewhere and then just calculate some emission or absorption rate. Okay, so we will assume that the quantum field phi starts out in a state that we may call alpha, where alpha could be the Minkowski vacuum. In this case, we would write alpha is the vector zero. Or we could also, if we wanted to know about absorption rates, we could, for example, assume that the field starts in a one particle state, in which case the state alpha would be the one particle state where you have one particle in with momentum k. Right? So the k-mode oscillator is in its first excited state, and all the other mode oscillators are in the state zero, in the ground state. But we will focus on this case later on. And we will assume that the detector starts out in its ground state. So that's the initial state of the detector, and that we will usually assume to be the initial state of the field. So the combined state of the combined system of detector plus field is what we call the psi initial. The initial state is a tensor product of the ground state of the detector and the alpha state of the field, which might be the vacuum, for example. Then we need to calculate the time evolution of that state. According to the Dirac picture, all we need to do is take this initial state and then run the time evolution operator on it for amount of time tau, and then we get the state that we are in now. Where, remember in the Dirac picture, this is the time evolution operator arising from the Schrödinger equation that contains only the interaction Hamiltonian, but all its operators are time dependent according to the Heisenberg evolution, according to the evolution of the free operators. All right. And then we want to check for particle creation. We want to check if the detector gets excited. So the problem is this. What is the probability amplitude that if we measure at some later time tau the detector system, that it will be found to have detected something, which is to say that it will be in an excited state like En. That's what we will want to know. So what we need to calculate is the following probability amplitude. We calculate the full state of the system of detector plus field, psi of tau, and then we calculate at the time tau later on, time tau, we calculate what is the overlap with this state. So we are asking, after the time evolution happened for an amount of time tau, what's the probability amplitude for finding the quantum field in some state omega and the detector in some excited state En, where we can try out various omegas for the field. We can, for example, ask what's the probability amplitude for finding the field in the vacuum state still, but the detector excited. Or what's the probability for the field to be excited, but the detectors to be still in the ground state. Anything goes. And then the modulus squared of that number is the probability for it to have happened. So we want to calculate the total detection probability, and by that I mean if we wait an infinite amount of time. So the probability that if we wait for an infinite amount of time, that the field will end up in a state omega, whose nature we can choose arbitrarily. Could be the vacuum state, could be some excited state, and the detector is in an excited state, that probability amplitude is given by this overlap here, namely initial state of the field, alpha, initial state of the detector, ground state, and then that is in perturbation theory the time evolution operator for this state. So all of this is the time-evolved state of our detector field system. And how far do we evolve it? Well, all the way to future infinity, from minus infinity to plus infinity. We can always limit the time if we want to by modulating the epsilon of tau, because that's a parameter we just sneak in there in order to allow ourselves to switch on and off the interaction between our detector system and the field system. Now let's see. There is something we can tell right away, which is that this identity drops out. Why? Well, let's see. We have this state, identity, and then that state. The overlap between this state and that state is zero, because already the first factor here is orthogonal. The En is orthogonal to the E0, because the nth excited state of the detector is orthogonal to the ground state of the detector. Therefore, this term with the zero, it goes away. It doesn't matter what the overlap between the omega and the alpha is, this the initial and the final state of the field. So that term goes away right away. And therefore, the probability amplitude for the excitation of the detector and the field to go from the state alpha to the state omega is given by this. Okay? So two things happened from this equation to that equation. First thing that happened is we dropped this one. And the second thing that happens is that we contracted these things according to their tensor factors. You see, this is an operator in the Hilbert space of the detector. That's an operator in the Hilbert space of the field. And this is a state in the Hilbert space of the detector and that of the field, similarly here. So really what we have here is that apart from that integral and the epsilon, we have that it's En q hat E naught times omega phi hat alpha. So if you write it all out, that's what we get. We get that this probability amplitude for this thing to happen, for the field to go from the state alpha to the state omega, and for the detector to go from the ground state to the nth excited state, is given by the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, I times epsilon of tau. And then it's this factor here, which is a so-called transition matrix element from E naught to En, with this operator from the hydrogen atom or whatever our detector is. And here we have the transition matrix element of the initial state of the field to the final state of the field, and we have the field operator in between. Okay, so we'd have to work out this thing. And for that, we need to know what this is as a function of tau and what that is as a function of tau. Can we figure this out? Fortunately, we can. And the reason is that the time evolution of our operators in the interaction Hamiltonian is the free time evolution. Remember? That was the point of using the Dirac picture, the interaction picture. These operators evolve according to the free time evolution, which we can work out, because it's free. So in particular, the q hat of tau is whatever the operator was at the initial time, q hat 0, and then the time evolution here of the free detector. And then for the field, remember at the beginning of the lecture today, we wrote out exactly what its time evolution is. Right? We expressed the field in terms of its Fourier transform and the Fourier transform in terms of the Einar dagger. All of that mess goes into here. Okay, so this goes into here, and all of that mess about how the phi hat looks like is actually not that much of a mess, it's still Minkowski space, and that goes into here. Let's see what happens when we do this. This is what happens. Oh, I should explain. So we said that the q hat of tau evolves according to the free time evolution. So here we have the free Hamiltonian of the detector. And here again, the free Hamiltonian of the detector. And this thing goes in here. And you see, these free Hamiltonians of the detector act to the left and to the right onto eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian of the detector. So we have here the H-naught detector acting on E-naught. Well, that's going to produce an E-naught. So this is just going to be E-naught over here. And similarly here, this is acting here to the left onto the En. But you see, En is an eigenstate of the detector with eigenvalue En. So therefore, this matrix element simply becomes En, Q naught, E naught, right? So it's Q naught, and then this simply becomes e to the power I, En tau. That's this, e to the power I, En tau. And that term becomes e to the power minus I, E naught tau. That's this term, e to the power of minus I, E naught tau. And then we still have the matrix element of En left, E naught to the right, and the Q hat naught in the middle. So that's what we get here. That simplified a bit. And then on the right-hand side, we still have to plug in what the phi hat of x and tau is. And I wrote down in black here and what that was. So this is the expression of phi hat in terms of the A and A dagger operators, whose action on the state of the field we know immediately. So all of this goes into here. And this, by the way, is a number that no longer depends on time, which is great, because it means we can pull it out of the integral. It's some number. Now, in practice, what that number is depends on what our unruly detector is. If it's an H2 system and we are considering the vibration of proton against proton, then that's going to be a different number, because different operator and so on, right? It's going to be a different number than if it's the hydrogen atom and we're looking at its excitation. And let's say we want to know what the excitation probability is of the hydrogen atom going from the ground state to the seventh excited state with such and such magnetic numbers and whatever, then that's some number here. But we don't need to care about this for the general picture here. Only if we want to know it for a special case, then we would have to work out what that is. But the point is, it's not dependent on time anymore. All of the time dependence is captured in these. No matter what the circumstances are, molecule, ion, atom, always goes like this. Now, this thing we can pull in front. It's just some number that gives an overall multiplicative factor. And this goes into here. And you see, we can now calculate the probability amplitudes for any kind of absorption and emission processes. Because remember, we chose the field to start in the ground state. That's why there's an E naught here. We chose to look for the field to be in its excited state. That's why there's an En over there. We could have chosen the other way around. We could have chosen the field to be prepared in the excited state. Then the En would be here. We could ask what's the probability that it decays to its ground state. The En naught would be over there. What difference does it make? The sign would flip here, right? Then we would have E naught minus En instead of En minus E naught. You may wonder, oh, okay, what difference does it make? We will see. It makes a huge difference. And here, we still left open the choice. What we choose for the initial state of the field, well, alpha could be the vacuum state. Omega could be the seventh excited state. We have seven particles flying around in some direction. Or this could be the vacuum state. That could be an excited state. This is your starting point if you want to calculate any emission or absorption processes. You could also, for example, have the atom excited and then shoot in a photon that has the same frequency as the decay frequency of that atom. That is to say, the energy difference between the excited state and the ground state. Then you will find the phenomenon of induced emission, which is super important in lasers, of course, where in a laser, the light that's already existing is triggering more emission from the atoms. All right, here we will see something super important right now, which is the relationship between alpha and omega so that this is non-zero. Because usually, if you choose this to be, let's say, the vacuum state, and this the seventh excited state, usually if you do something like this, it gets zero. Why? Do you see why that's zero? If this is the ground state, and this is like a seventh excited state, then that matrix element is zero. Never mind what that is. The whole thing, the whole probability amplitude always goes to zero. Why? Because the phi contains exactly a linear power of a dagger and a linear power of a. Right? So, in particular, that term, all of this, you can forget if this is the vacuum state. Because the a is going to act on the vacuum state and kill it. So if this is the vacuum state, that is gone. We still have this acting on the vacuum state to produce a one particle state, right? You can only have each oscillator excited at most once by acting with this on the vacuum state. But this means that the capital omega better be chosen to be a one excitation state. It's just each harmonic oscillator is excited at most once. Because if it's like a state with a harmonic oscillator excited twice, two particles of the same momentum, then there is no way that this could be a non-zero amplitude. Because how would you get a state that's excited twice? You would have to apply a dagger twice. Or actually, because it's to the left, it's a squared twice. Then with the commutation relations with the a dagger, that would always it would all go away. The only way you can have a non-zero term in here is if you have the same number of A's and A daggers, so that when you then commute them through each other, you get a finite contribution. Otherwise, there's going to be an A left over to kill to the right, or an A dagger left over to kill the term to the left. Right, so what we see here is that the difference in particle number has to be one between here and there. You can either excite one, so you can either go from the vacuum to the once excited state, or you can go from the once excited state to the vacuum. You can go from the 27th excited state to the 28th excited state, or to the 26th excited state. But you cannot jump more than one. Is this a non-perturbative result or a perturbative result? Remember, we do just first order calculations here. If we went to second order, would we find the same? Why not? You're right, but why not? Well, the answer is we would get an h squared. Right? We could get an h squared with time ordering and stuff. But an h squared would involve phi squared, which means we get a dagger, and a terms. Now, into second order calculation, we can have the production of two photons at once, or the destruction of two photons at once. So the higher you go in perturbation theory, the rarer the processes you get. So the most likely process is always just absorption or emission of one photon, but you can do two in a go, but only if you go to higher order. So it's always a less likely process to happen. Okay, so in phi hat of x, only the terms proportional to a dagger k can contribute. If this is the vacuum state, because this term goes away, right? So we go from the vacuum state to the first excited state. That's all we can do. If we start with the vacuum, only non-zero probabilities arise if we ask, is the particle in an excited, is the detector in an excited, is the field in a once excited state later on? Right, remember that quantum field theoretical states can always be written as a linear combination of some prefactor times the ground state, plus some sum over or integral over one particle states, plus sum or integral over two particle states, etc. Remember that you don't have to have a clean particle number, not for photons, for example. For electrons you do, but not for photons. You can have quantum uncertain particle numbers. So you can generally have this combination here. So since we know already that to first order, the leading order effect that we see experimentally, the only term that matters is the one particle states, let us focus on that. Let us ask, what is the probability that after the time evolution, the field is in a one particle state? So it has some chance of being, we ask, does it have a chance? What is the probability for finding that the field has one photon of momentum k tilde in it? So that's what we will ask. So we start with the vacuum state and then we ask, what's the probability amplitude for finding the particle in this state here? So now what do we have? The probability, if we wait forever, of the detector to go from the ground state to the nth excited state, and the field to go from the vacuum state to the state where there is one particle of momentum k tilde, is given by this expression here. Remember, this term we had above, now we pull it in front of the integral, which is legal because it doesn't depend on the time. The time dependence here, of course, matters. And here we now have an A and an A dagger, as it should be. The A dagger doesn't annihilate to the right, the A doesn't annihilate to the left. We can use now the canonical commutation relations to write the A dagger as A dagger A plus Dirac delta. You see, it's an A of k tilde and an A dagger of k. And then we get that term in here. Remember where this comes from? This is because we are asking whether what the probability amplitude is for finding this final state of the field. Do you remember where that A dagger came from? From the field, right? It came from the field, because when we express the field, where is it? Oh. See, when we express the field, phi hat of x and tau, the field was expressed in terms of A dagger and A terms. And the A term gone away because it acted on the vacuum state. This A dagger is left over. That's where the A dagger comes from that we see here now, right? That's this A dagger left over with its prefactors from the general solution of the field. Okay, so now we commute those guys so that the A is on the right and annihilates and goes away, but we pick up the Dirac delta term. Here it is written out. So that Dirac delta term will set this K equal to that K tilde. And that will kill that integral, the D3K integral. And instead, we have that all the K occurrences become K tilde occurrences. So, as we go from here to there, we are only left with one integral, the time integral here. Proper time integral along, tau is the proper time of the detector. All right, so we have this prefactor given by this matrix element that depends on the exact physics of whether we deal with a diatomic molecule or an atom or ion. And then we have this complicated integral to carry out. At this point, we are ready to choose a trajectory. We've made our choice of what quantum states we prepare, what quantum states we're looking for. We're preparing the field in the vacuum state, the detector in the ground state. And therefore, we would expect nothing to happen. But if we accelerate, maybe something will happen. Maybe there's a probability amplitude. So we are asking, what's the probability amplitude for finding the field in an excited state, for finding the field with the mode oscillator, for the mode k tilde to be excited? So this is to say, what's the probability amplitude for finding one photon of momentum k tilde, and that the detector gets excited to its nth excited state? That's the question we're asking, that's the answer. But the answer will depend on the trajectory that we plug in. Now, for consistency, let's check it for the inertial observer first, where we would expect nothing to happen. It's just sitting there in its ground state, right? So the special case that we will consider is, as we said, the vacuum state is the initial state, and the detector is inertial. If the detector is inertial, its trajectory is simply tau 0, 0, 0. It just moves only in time, not in space. Then, what do we get? If we plug this trajectory for x mu of tau into this formula, the x vector of tau and the x naught of tau, if we plug that particular thing in here, later we will plug in other trajectories. If you plug that in here, then what do we get? So we have here the x vector of tau, the x naught of tau, and in practice, the x vector of tau for the inertial detector, it's just sitting at the origin, x vector of tau is zero and stays zero. But the x naught of tau is non-trivial, and it is just tau. So this is the integral that we now have to work out, which we can do, because this doesn't depend on tau. We can pull this in front. Actually, to the back, I put it over here. And all we have to do is now the integral over this exponentials here. Actually, that e somehow got lost. There's got to be an e here. Right, so we have all of this here in the exponent of an exponential. But what is that? What do you get when you integrate over a plane wave? You get a Dirac delta. Right, so this integral we can carry out, and it is up to prefactors that involve that matrix element that depends on whether we deal with atoms or molecules or ions. Apart from that, we get here a Dirac delta. Of En minus E naught plus omega k. Now, En is larger than E naught. And omega k is always positive, because it's the square root of k vector squared plus m squared. So therefore, this argument is always positive. No matter what momentum photons we are looking for, this is going to be positive. And since we're looking for an excitation of the detector, yep, bad luck. This is never going to happen. This Dirac delta is just zero no matter what, because its argument is always larger than zero. So that means the whole amplitude that we calculated is zero now for the inertial detector. Now, what question could we have asked for the inertial detector such that this would not have come out to be zero? Any guesses? Well, we could have asked, for example, what the decay rate is. So we could have started out with a detector that is excited. And the vacuum in the ground, and the field in the ground stayed in the vacuum state, but the detector starts out in the excited state. And then we could ask, what's the probability for finding the ground state later on, and a photon emitted of momentum k vector. Now, what would have changed in the calculation? E naught and En would have traded places. That's all that would have happened, which means that everything goes through the same, but here would be E naught minus En, right? But what is E naught minus En? That's the energy difference between the excited state and the ground state. And then this Dirac delta here says that this negative number, the difference between the ground state and the excited state, has to match exactly the energy of the photon that we are looking for. Then we have that the Dirac delta peaks. Right? So if there's E naught minus En, then that's negative. And it is the amount of energy that the atom is available to give by decaying into its ground state. And then if the photon that we're looking for, because we get to choose the k tilde here, right? If we choose a k tilde whose omega or h bar omega is the amount of energy that the atom has to give, then we are in resonance. Right? So what we see is that if we ask the question, what's the probability amplitude for a detector to go from the nth excited state to the ground state and a photon to be emitted of momentum k tilde? Then the answer is, that depends on what k tilde is. If you choose k tilde to be matching the energy gap here, so that omega of k tilde is the energy gap, well then yes, otherwise zero. And if it is yes, then isotropically, any of these k tilde has the same probability amplitude. That's because we have a scalar field here, and so there is no vectorial dimension to this. For electromagnetism, it wouldn't be quite right. Right? It depends on which orbital, from which orbital you go to the ground state in the hydrogen atom, in which direction the photons are preferentially emitted into. So that will be a little bit more complicated, but in principle, the calculation is exactly the same. All right, so this is how you calculate emission and absorption rates, and we also saw that the detector doesn't want to get excited, the field doesn't want to get excited if the particle is just sitting there. Now, let us look at the case where the detector is non-inertial. We could choose, for example, the uniform acceleration. Now, if the detector is not inertial, then the claim was that we will get excitation. Let's see how that comes about. Well, the probability amplitude for the detector to become excited, if it starts out in the ground state and the field in the vacuum state, is now calculated in this way. It's the same formula as before, except that in the trajectory here, in this expression of the, we put in another trajectory. So we can look at it in the following way. This integral over tau is a Fourier transform. Here we have the Fourier factor. Okay? And we may call this the excitation energy En minus E naught. So we are Fourier transforming this function and evaluating it at the excitation energy of the detector. We saw that if this is exactly the frequency omega k, maybe for the inertial detector sitting just there, then this is just omega k tau, then the Fourier transform of this, the Fourier transform of this is just a Dirac delta, right? Which peaks at the resonance where the frequency of the photon matches the energy gap. But in general, this will be no plane wave. If the trajectory is some, let's say you have a monkey on the in the controls of a spaceship, right? Then this is not going to be uniform acceleration or anything like that. So a Mankey-navigated spaceship is going to have some non-trivial trajectory, which translates into some non-plane wave behavior of this, non-monochromatic wave. But if it's a non-monochromatic wave, then the Fourier transform of it is not going to be a Dirac delta. And if it's not a Dirac delta, generically, we will have that the Fourier transform of this function, this is, you know, what would have been a plane wave, but Mankey-navigated spaceships don't have that. So this function will have a much more complicated Fourier transform. So here this excitation energy, and in general, this has no reason to be zero, this integral. Which means that the excitation probability of the detector, along with the excitation probability of the field for one particle to be created, is not zero in general. What it is, you can work out by choosing a trajectory and just calculating that integral, which might be hard because it could be very highly oscillatory integral. And in principle, you can carry this out. For example, for the trajectory that corresponds to uniform acceleration. Because then, as we will see later in the course, then the integral turns out to be transformable into the form of a gamma function, and then you can get that. But these technical details would take a little long, and since we are going to do this anyway, again, when we calculate the Unruh effect from a different perspective, I'm not doing the details here. But the point here is that in general, for some generic trajectory, you will have excitation of both the detector and the field, and in sync, right? We know that if and only if the detector gets excited, does the field get excited, because you must have the two things happen together there because of the structure of the A and A daggers there. All right, and the next time we will see the Unruh effect, the next time that we will see it will not be the next lecture. It will be much further down the road. But when we will see it then we will not define particles as what a detector sees, but instead we will define particles as excitations of mode oscillators, and we will see the same phenomenon, namely that acceleration leads to mode oscillators to be excited. So even if in a vacuum it looks like there are no particles, for an accelerated observer it looks like there are. And then we will connect that to the Hawking effect, where the role of acceleration will be played by gravity. Okay, so much today. Any questions? Yep?
So for the energy eigenstates, so in this picture you said the states are evolved under the interaction of a bonus, right? And when you apply Bra of En, do you not also evolve that eigenstate under the interaction Hamiltonian at t equal to tau, let's say?
No, be careful. We did, because remember, we wrote down the initial state and the final state, and then we evolved them under the interaction Hamiltonian, and then the interaction Hamiltonian had to be expressed in terms of the operators in the Heisenberg picture, right? And once we did that, we had then this Q hat operator that came from the interaction Hamiltonian, but had time dependence in it. And we had then this Q hat operator evolve in time, according to the Heisenberg picture, where the free Hamiltonian was in there. And that allowed us then to pull out this, this term here. And so I understand how it looks like. We just free evolved our states here. But we didn't, because the origin of these terms is that we evolve our Q hat operator in time according to the interaction Hamiltonian, where the operators in the interaction Hamiltonian are evolving freely. Right? So it was the interaction Hamiltonian that did it. It's just that the actual time dependence in the interaction Hamiltonian came from the free evolution of the operators because of the way that this thing is set up. But we really evolved the states in time there. Yeah. So we evolved the total state in time using the interaction Hamiltonian.